Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I was born in Little Rock, had a childhood sweetheart.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have so much information to share, so many insights, special audio clips, investigative reporting. We have a wonderful guest. In fact, we have an exclusive interview with one of America's best attorneys, and Mr. Pepper is going to be here, William Pepper, and he is going to show you, detail for you, why Sirhan Sirhan was not responsible for the death of Robert F. Kennedy by himself, and he was programmed. This will be an interesting conversation. So you won't want to miss that. That'll be in the second part of our program. Also, we're going to be talking today about legalizing marijuana. I believe that all drugs should be legalized, and then those who've had drug problems should be treated not as if they have a disease, but as if they have an addictive problem that has created imbalances in their brain and in their body, and help them regain a sense of their authentic self, detoxify them so they can reenter society. I also believe all those people in prison who are there for drug-related crimes, not violent crimes. I'm not talking about murderers, but I'm talking about people using drugs. They should all be freed and their records expunged. Now, I believe we shouldn't have a war on drugs, but then again, I believe we shouldn't have a war on terrorism because we're just creating terrorism. We shouldn't have a war on poverty. We just created more poverty. We shouldn't have a war on cancer. We just create more cancer and lots of money for the people who know how to exploit these. There's a different approach we should take for all these conditions to help those who are poor, help those who are homeless, help those who are sick, help those who need help. So I'm going to deal with that today. And I'm also going to give you some insights into issues that show you just how much we have evolved from a goodwill society, one that is really a champion of human rights and natural rights, to one that is exploiting everything. And who are these people and how are they doing it? So that's what we're up to. I realize some of you are listening by telephone and others may not be available by a land-based radio station to listen. Let me give you two numbers. One, you can listen anywhere in Canada or the United States by telephone. The other is an archive number in case you have to listen in the evening or some other time. You can download up to 5 programs with a single call. Here's the Listen Live number. Please write it down. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Always has that number with you. The other is our archive number. 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. I'm going to do things in shorter segments today to try to get as much as I can in. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from a good study that was done at Louisiana State University, and it talked about walnuts and how they can help give you we already know it gives us a good heart and helps prevent heart disease. This shows you how it can help the good bacteria in your gut. So the conclusions from this new animal study suggest that walnut consumption, we're not talking about a lot, not even a handful of walnuts each day, can enhance digestion, increase the amount of good probiotic type bacteria in the gut. And they do this by acting as a prebiotic to help nourish and grow the bacteria that keeps the digestive system healthy. And researchers found that a diet with walnuts led to an overall significant increase in the diversity of good bacteria in the gut. Quote from the study, "Gut health is an emerging research area, but we are seeing that greater bacterial diversity may be associated with better health outcomes, whereas low diversity has been linked to conditions such as obesity and inflammatory bowel disease." And this was looking at the good bacteria that come from eating walnuts. Now, you're also getting your omega-3 fatty acids. In fact, you're getting a good amount, and they're only looking at 2.5 grams per ounce. So you are getting amino acids, you're getting protein, you're getting 4 grams of protein per ounce. So let's just say you had 2 ounces of nuts. That's a good amount. That's 8 grams of protein. That's more protein than you're getting in an egg. That's more protein you're getting in a can of black beans. So people think, well, if you're a vegan, Gary, how are you getting your amino acids? Well, it's simple. I have nuts or nut butters made from ground-up nuts every single day in my diet. That's how you do it. I also consume every day seaweed. Now, sometimes it's just as a seaweed salad, just by itself. Now, you can make it as interesting and exotic. What I like to do is I like to, when I'm feeding people, let's say I'm doing a retreat, and at least one day in the retreat I do the cooking, and I'll make a salad, and I'll put maybe 5 different types of sea vegetables in there, and it has different mouthfeels and different tastes, and it's easy to make seaweed. You simply take your seaweeds, Elaria, whatever type you want, and wakame, kombu, and you soak it in water for a few minutes and rinse it, soak it and rinse it. You can cook it for just about 5 minutes at a low temperature, and then you run cold water over it. Then you can take some pieces of radish or daikon, and if it's daikon, you shave the daikon, maybe 1/4 cup in the salad. You can take a teaspoon of mustard, which is, by the way, very good for you, and add in some ginger, diced fresh ginger, and stir that into the seaweed mixture, and then put that on a bed of sunflower sprouts, and then on top sprinkle fresh pomegranates. And you talk about a wonderful exotic salad. It's delicious. You could sprinkle a little bit of marion on it also, which gives it an oriental and unique taste. But we should have seaweed in our diet because it nourishes the bones and also nourishes the thyroid gland. It's great food for the thyroid. Especially we are a nation that has an underactive thyroid, which leads to weight gain, slower metabolism, fatigue, and inability to sleep. This is a different. This comes from the Louvain Drug Research Institute in Belgium. And they find that one seaweed called spirulina. Now, spirulina is a very unique seaweed. It was very popular back in the early 1970s. And at that time, it all came from a lake down in Mexico, and it was very expensive, but it was kind of like the first of the wonder foods, the superfoods. And for years, that was the only one, was spirulina, spire, S-P-I-R, ulina, U-L-I-N-A, spirulina. We now can see from this new published article in this peer-reviewed journal, Nutrients, helps protect against age-related liver inflammation by modifying pathways in the microbiome. So, in lay language, when you consume spirulina, you're protecting your liver, which against what we call hepatic is liver, inflammation. And the older you get, the more susceptible you are to inflammation of the liver. Why? Because of all the different times in life people drank alcohol, or people had high fructose corn syrup, those soft drinks that we are consuming an enormous amount of, and other beverages that have high fructose corn syrup. That causes what is known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And tens of millions of Americans suffer from this, and this can kill you. It also disrupts normal metabolism. So even when you're eating right, it doesn't mean that the nutrients are actually being utilized at the cellular level if your liver is not able to metabolize them properly. So make sure you're getting spirulina each day, and that will make an enormous difference. This is from the study. Quote, the fact that its oral consumption can influence both gut immunity and systemic sites such as the liver suggests that its immune action is not confined to the gut immune system. In the management of immune alterations and aging based on gut microbe host interaction. So that's merely saying in lay language, take your spirulina, have healthier liver. also from University of Utah, published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, mindfulness. Mindfulness means simply being present. Now, you may think, well, we're present all the time, Gary. What are you talking about? No, we're not. In fact, the average person has about 56,000 different thoughts per day. That's a lot of thoughts. And that means each one of the thoughts is for that short period of time, however long we're thinking on that, it diverts attention away to the task at hand. And it's one of the things about Buddhist meditation and other forms of Zen meditation is that it brings you to a point of focus where you try, over a period of time by training your mind, you try to block anything that would distract you to keep your mind on an issue. There have been some remarkable athletes that we've had the joy and the pleasure of watching them perform for us. One of those athletes was Roger Clemens. Now, he was accused of taking steroids to keep his muscle mass up and his strength, but long before he was accused of doing that, he had a remarkable, long career and won multiple Cy Young awards without using them. And when asked once how he had so many strikeouts, he simply said something to the effect that when I'm looking at that batter, I'm not seeing the batter, I'm seeing a strikeout box. I don't hear the crowd, I'm in the zone. And so all my energy is keeping in the zone. The same is true for many great hitters. When they got up there, nothing distracted them. They were completely mindful, same way with any other sport, any other athleticism. And as a runner, as a competitive athlete, my entire adult life, still competing. In fact, next year I train for the World Games, which takes about a year to train, by the way. You got to do about 5-6 hours a day of training to have any opportunity to do well in the World Games. And I've done 4 World Games, and I've won in every one. So I'm going to put some serious training in. But I can tell you that if you have mindfulness on your side, you can do things athletically that you would normally not be able to achieve. And so in every task you do in life, everything, it's mindfulness. Now, we're a society that has gotten so used to looking up something on Google and having the answer immediately available, that's not mindfulness. That is passive learning. And passive learning means that we listen to music, but not music that's classical, that challenges us. If you haven't had a chance to listen to James Ursay, he is just one of the most uniquely gifted people. He uses humor. He uses great scholarship in a self-deprecating manner that he can tell you a great deal about a musician, its composition, what makes it listenable and original in ways that are just joyful. And he didn't get that by not being by being passive. And one of the reasons conductors live such long lives, and musicians frequently live long lives, classical musicians, is because they're constantly having to be proactive and not passive. When you're learning a new language, that's proactive. When you're let's say, learning new words to use in your vocabulary, that is proactive. But we have dumbed ourselves down, unfortunately, even culturally. When I go to the ballet or I go to the opera, I go to one of the art films, I almost always see gray-headed people. It's rare to see young people. It's rare to see young American people. You can certainly see some from Russia and Romania and Czechoslovakia and Italy and many other countries. And when you go to Rome, if you have a chance, you should, not just to Italy, and you go to Verona and some of the other places and they put on concerts, you'll see very young people because it's enculturated. So it's a challenge. It allows you to grow. So that's part of mindfulness, because you can't master things without mindfulness. You just can't. So here's what it's saying. It's saying mind-body therapies immediately reduce unimaginable pain in hospital patients. quote, mindfulness training and hypnotic suggestion significantly reduce acute pain experienced in hospital patients, according to the Journal of Internal Medicine. After participating in a single 15-minute session of one of these mind-body therapies, patients reported an immediate decrease in pain levels, similar to what one might expect from an opiate painkiller. The study is the first to compare the effects of mindfulness and hypnosis on acute pain in the hospital setting. And this was a year-long study done at the University of Utah Hospital in Salt Lake. Now, let's go back many years to where I was working at the Institute of Applied Biology, which was affiliated with Trafalgar Hospital, and I also was affiliated with Trafalgar Hospital. And at that time, there was a person who came wanting to see if biofeedback could help. And they started off with Dr. LeChan, and then they were sent over to me because I was dealing with people who were trying to withdraw from hard drugs, crack cocaine at that time, and heroin. And the traditional way that they would help people was through methadone and or going cold turkey. And I mean, you would see people in a room that would do projectile vomiting like something out of The Exorcist, clear across a room, hitting the far wall, and sweating profusely and this kind of strange yellowish-green sweat. These are the toxins coming out of the body. So we implemented a mindfulness, and there was also a couple of Buddhists came in to teach meditation. We had a person teaching biofeedback, just keeping your mind focused. In this case, they had one of those like those little TikTok that you do in music where it goes back and forth and back and forth for rhythm. And they would try to synchronize their brain and their breathing and their point of focus. And then we would ask them, how are you doing with the pain? And the pain was gone. And we're talking about severe pain when you're trying to withdraw. And the withdrawal was so much easier that it became the program that we therefore used after that is mindfulness meditation, helping people get off any form of addictive substance. Also help them with headaches, etc. Something to think about. And finally, from our health nutrition, vitamin D is associated with a lower risk of breast cancer. This is from the National Institutes of Health. This is from the current journal, from Environmental Health Perspectives. They published the study that was done at the National Institute of Health of lowering the risk of breast cancer. This was a 5-year follow-up, and they found a substantial reduction in breast cancer when you were taking your vitamin D every day. In fact, it was 24.6% or 21% less. That's a huge difference. That's just one nutrient. I could show also vitamin C could reduce breast cancer, and quercetin could reduce breast cancer, and vitamin E can reduce breast cancer. But this is just one, vitamin D. So for all the women in this audience who are concerned about preventing breast cancer, I would say 3,000 to 5,000 units a day of the hydroxyvitamin D, which is vitamin D3. Okay? That's the latest on health nutrition. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you, and we're just going to make a little mention. I apologize to all the other syndicated programs listening to us right now, but I'm going to do a premiere as a fundraiser where all the money, 100%, everything collected at the door, will go to our sister station, WBAI, exclusively and only to pay for outstanding premiums by the different producers across the board at the station, not just mine. I'm willing to do this. I'm even giving each of the people who attend a free copy of the film itself. The film is Plant Codes, and so we're helping the station that needs a great deal of help. And so this is one way we can help them and the people who want to come and enjoy the film, which I'm sure you're going to appreciate because it's a rather remarkable film. Now, if you'd like to join us, and it's you'll get all the information from WBI's website. You can go to their website, and they'll tell you the day it is. It's going to be in August. It's near the beginning of August. It's on a Tuesday evening. And for location, et cetera, I'm going to give you a number to call. 516-620-3602. Again, call this number and say you want to go to the premiere of WBI's Plant Codes. 516-620-3602. I'll be there, and everyone will get a copy of the film. That's on me. I'm giving that as a gift, and it'll help raise money. And immediately, instead of going into the general fund, that will go to purchase premiums from different producers to help their audience get out the spring drive premiums. So that's good. Now, I'm going to play you a clip. And this clip, I believe, is very important. It's a this is a clip of a congressman asking a question about the head of the Drug Enforcement Agency about marijuana. And I think that you will appreciate this. I'm not going to play the whole thing, but there's two people talking to the head of the agency. And A, the head of the agency seems clueless about the science, and B, the two legislators who have large staffs and tremendous resources, none of them have a clue of what they're talking about. Listen in, please.
Director Baum, in case my mom is watching, I want to be really clear. I'm not advocating for the legalization of marijuana. I will be very, very clear about that. However, I don't understand why it's a Schedule I. It's certainly not treated as a inherently dangerous substance for which there is no medicinal value. It takes a tractor trailer full of marijuana to even trigger a mandatory minimum under our drug laws. So is there any appetite for researching whether or not it should remain a Schedule I drug?
Congressman, the administration doesn't have a position on that, but I'm happy to dialogue with your office. And let me just briefly say that we strongly support research on medical use of marijuana. And if there are obstacles that we see that prevent good research, we want to address those obstacles. Because if there are component elements of marijuana that could be put through the FDA process and turned into medicines that could help people in this country, we want to do that. So we do think there's some potential, and we support research on the subject.
Well, just so everyone's clear, methamphetamine is scheduled what?
I believe it's scheduled
2. Cocaine is scheduled what?
Also 2.
Cocaine base is scheduled what?
2.
So it is scheduled lower than marijuana. And again, you can schedule something and still not have it scheduled as a 1. And I would encourage the powers that be, whoever you need to consult with in the administration, to at least explore whether or not it's scheduled correctly without being perceived as advocating for legalization.
Understood.
With that, Mr. Connolly, I will give you a chance to... I'm reluctant to say whatever you want, but I'm going to give you a chance to conclude.
I thank my friend, and I actually want to follow up, if I may, on what you just asked. So the point being made here in some ways, Mr. Baum, is if you, not you personally, if the government, federal government, on this subject, marijuana and how dangerous it is, has no credibility because of the lack of serious empirical work, it threatens our whole drug policy's credibility. And you're seeing this happen on marijuana in the states. They're making decisions. Ms. Norton talked about 8 states, but there are over 25 states that have in some fashion, including my home state of Virginia, liberalized their laws for medical reasons all the way to recreational reasons. I think you'd have to confess to the chairman's point, there was no empirical evidence to justify putting marijuana 50 years ago as a Schedule I drug. Who did that empirical evidence?
Sorry, could you repeat that? Who did what? Who made it Schedule
I? There was no, I am asserting, and yes, you can feel free to try to contradict, there was in fact no empirical evidence to justify putting marijuana ahead of the drugs the chairman just listed as a Schedule I drug 50 years ago. And I would, you brought up the need to have empirical research before we start rushing pell-mell to approve it for medical purposes, and I agree with you. But here's the problem, as I said in my opening statement. Only one federal entity, NIDA, controls marijuana for legal purposes for experimentation, testing, and the like, research. And NIDA's mission is all about proving the harms of something. They have a priori determined the outcome of research. Nobody thinks NIDA is an objective, neutral place to go to look at the good, the bad, and the indifferent about marijuana. It doesn't have that credibility. So if we're going to do what you suggest, we need to have a different entity with credibility where we're looking at objective evidence and science. And then we can determine, well, where does marijuana work?
So here's where we stand. Two very influential legislators, at least to their credit, I give them credit, said, why is this considered the most dangerous drug that you could take in America? Because that's what a Schedule I drug is. They make cocaine, crack, heroin, and methamphetamine less of a danger to you than they marijuana. But look at the actual science. No one dies from marijuana, but thousands, tens of thousands die from the other drugs, including the opiates. And he says, before we start doing medical research, that means to me that they're saying they're not aware of what's there. So here's what I'm doing. As of today, on the Progressive Radio Network's website, prn.fm, we are listing 600 studies that GreenMed Info and Sayer G has, and these are all from peer-reviewed literature, and that is just 600 out of 22,000 studies on the government's own database of scientific studies. And that's only for one component of marijuana, only one. There's two, and you put it both together, and you're dealing way up into almost 35,000 studies. And some of these studies have gone back for almost 40 years. So on the one hand, it is clear and unfortunate that millions of Americans have been adversely impacted by the law. Over a million have been imprisoned, their lives turned upside down, then the chaos that occurs when that happens because of a drug that does not hurt you. And here is the science that's already in existence. And I would like if people in this audience would send this to Trey Gowdy, the legislator, and his fellow legislator. Here's the actual existing peer-reviewed literature. And this was 2009, July, volume 163 from the Archives in Pediatric Adolescent Medicine. And this talked about the cannabinoids for treating chronic non-cancer pain, a systemic review of randomized trials. And it has multiple trials that it says the cannabinoids are very beneficial. In fact, 18 trials. Then you have this, molecular cancer research and potential cannabinoid-induced cytotoxicity in mantle cell lymphoma through modulation of ceramide metabolism. Again, cannabinoids helping with cancer. And again, cannabinoids inhibit the vascular endothelial growth factor pathway in gliomas, that's cancer. And this was in Cancer Research, 2004. So you're talking about a study done 13 years ago that's in the medical literature, that's in PubMed, their own database. Here's another one. Cannabinoid action induces autophagy-mediated cell death through stimulation in ER stress in human glioma cells, cancer. And toxicology letter, cannabinoids and their acids, a major cannabinoid in fiber-type cannabis, as an inhibitor of MDA-MB-231 breast cancer cells, so it helps stop breast cancer. Here's another one, cannabinoid for the treatment of psychosis and Parkinson's disease from the Psychopharmacology Journal, 2009, November, volume 23, the management of psychosis and Parkinson's with cannabinoids, a whole plant cannabis extract in the treatment of spastic multiple sclerosis, and this was in the British Medical Journal Neurology. A single-dose cannabinoid reduced blood pressure in healthy volunteers in a randomized crossover study. And this was in the JCI Insight Scientific Journal. This was in June of 2017. and acute and chronic cannabinoid extracts administered affect motor function in CREAFE model multiple sclerosis, again helping multiple sclerosis. And this was in the Journal of Endopharmacology, and in 2010, November 19th publication. Now I have thousands, I have tens of thousands of studies from the peer-reviewed literature proving cannabinoid scientific basis, double-blind studies. I mean double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled. Here's one. This is a multi-centered, meaning multiple different places, did this research. It was published in Human Reproduction in July 24th, 2009, and it is a, quote, multi-centered, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled, parallel group study on the efficacy, safety, and tolerability of THC and CBD extract in patients with intractable cancer pain. So think of all the millions of people who've had cancer pain. This could have been a non-toxic, natural, highly beneficial and efficacious and safe therapy. And they don't even know about it. So they're starting with the idea that maybe we should do some research. Oh, wow. You're 50 years behind. And the idea that you got to, you know, let his mother know that he doesn't want to legalize this stuff. Well, alcohol is legalized. People die. People are injured. Cirrhosis of the liver, heart attacks, strokes, prematurely aging, gastric cancers, colorectal cancers. And that's considered a recreational substance. It's not banned and it shouldn't be banned. You should be educated about alcohol, but then it's your right to take it. And so here's a substance that is not killing anyone, hasn't killed anyone, has enormous medical benefit. The science has already proven you don't need any more science. You just need to legalize it at the state level. So the state activists, what I'm saying now is I'm posting scientific studies that if you choose to be an activist in your local state to help legalize it for medical purposes, you have that opportunity now because the evidence is there. So that's our public health issue of the day. And now we're going to go over, because I promised we would do some questions from the audience, and we have up online now to ask your questions. And you can ask your questions either calling in live at 888-874-4888, or you can go to prnstudio@gmail.com. And it's Elizabeth who's here to ask her questions. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hi. We've got a really nice one here. A long-time listener, Roger, was speaking with his father, who is an old acquaintance of yours and who has not spoken to you for more than 20 years. Well, he had a very interesting conversation with him during his visit to the city this week. His father was reminiscing about how many years ago he would attend these Wednesday evening get-togethers that you would also attend in New York, where a group of six or so intellectuals would sit around a table and would listen to and discuss issues that would challenge a person's knowledge. And you would each prepare for one conversation that could go on from anywhere from an hour to up to 4 hours. His father says he was never at the table himself. He would sit in the living room adjacent to the dining room with some others, where they'd listen in and marvel at an exciting exchange of ideas going on. He remembered that amongst those enlightened minds was one Dr. Linus Pauling. He wants to know, did you ever carry this on after you've moved? And if not, what do you do now for intellectual stimulation? Also, he would like to offer you a challenge today of a type that's not commonly asked or discussed. You talk about the problems we face from those in power, and you always use historical precedent as if to suggest that nothing ever changes. So his dad, Roger's dad, asks you, how would Dante look at the world today?
Dante?
Yes.
Dante, the Italian poet and moral philosopher?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Well, he was the author of a trilogy of poems called The Divine Comedy. He was born back in the midnight, 1260 to 65. He didn't live a long life, but he is considered to this day the father of modern Italian language. And you would be hard-pressed today anywhere in the world to find any author capable of doing the work that the Divine Comedy illustrated. And he himself lived kind of a tortured life because he was an activist. He was a very cerebral person, but did not have a happy upbringing because he was forced by his mother to marry or be guaranteed for marriage with a woman he had never met at a very young age. I think it was 9 or 10. And then he was thrown out of the powerful, there was a powerful pope at the time, Pope Boniface VIII, who forced Dante to leave Florence, and he lived in exile. So he was, when he was in exile, that's when he got into his real groove. And he began to use magic mushrooms, yeah, clear back then. And that's when he became very creative. But he also looked at everyone and everything in his life. I'm going to ask our engineer to pull her volume down because there's crackling in my ears. Thank you. So anyhow, so Dante looked at the world around him. So if I'm asked how would I look at the world around me today, and how would I juxtapose people who are, I would consider sociopathic or greedy, both individuals and whole groups of people, and how would I combine that with Dante's and Dante's concept of life? Well, Dante believed that there were 9 circles, and each circle represented a different stage of maladaptation. That's what we'll call it. The first circle was called limbo, and it was regarded as an inferior form of heaven with an eternal minor punishment for virtuous non-Christians and unbaptized pagans and children. So think historically of Homer, Socrates, Aristotle, Cicero, Hippocrates. They would reside there. Now, were these people bad? No. Were they evil? No. Were they commissioned to do things that represented a backward step? No. But they were not graced by being true believers and true followers. In effect, today they would be considered kind of progressives. So think of the people that are condemned by society. Think of Chris Hedges. Think of Cornel West. Think of Glenn Ford, Nellie Bailey, and Bruce Dixon. Think of the people who are not afraid to stand up and challenge the orthodoxy, and they're punished and condemned and marginalized to this kind of first circle, the limbo. So nobody pays attention to them except for the few voices that care to hear their voice. So that's how I would relegate that first voice. And it was a 7-walled tower. There was eternal sorrow without any torment. It was calm, but it was sad. So when you think of the great minds today, how many of them are quiet and sad? How many great minds, their phones never ring, they're never called, no one ever reads about them because all forums are reserved for those who are hip and in the moment and can be exploited by their exaggerated sense of importance. And the quality of their scholarship is so dreadfully superficial, and the entire society, once you accept this, is dumbed down to that level. And yet these other people who are the true minds and true intellects, no one pays attention. And in fact, the Council of Angels voted to the level of the 7-walled castle centuries ago, but there was no resources to construct a new one. And all the workers were too busy being tormented in hell. So the residents of limbo were let free. Now think of this as a metaphor today for all the people working every day, starting in the 1950s, the man in the gray flannel suit, the wife stayed at home, was supposed to be there only as a form of unpaid domestic servant to raise children and to keep the house and put food on the table. But the husband was to go dutifully off and do the same as everything he was doing every day in the same way without changing, and hence this great source of gray, this sense of alienating a person from their creativity, from their experimentation, from the real joy of life. You were supposed to find your joy within your quiet little domain of security. So your security became a straitjacket. The more insecure you were, the tighter the straitjacket became. Then your second circle was lust, and punishment is is being blown violently back and forth by strong winds, and you can't find any peace. Think of the people who were lustful, Cleopatra, Tristan, Helen of Troy. These were the adulterers. Now think of the people today who their lives are so boring they have to go up on this website. I forgot the name of the website where all the adulterers go. There's millions, tens of millions of them up on this adulterer's website. And if your life is so boring that you cannot find meaning in it, then you're boring. And therefore, you need something to distract you from your own self, something to appeal to you because you can't appeal to your own higher consciousness because you're not in touch with it. You're grounded to your lower instincts, which are primal, reptilian. So that's that second circle. The third circle was gluttony. Boy, do we have a lot of people that could... this is where the residents are guarded by a giant worm monster, Cerberus. And you have to live in a vile cesspool of slush created by never-ending icy rain. Now, think to me that would be all your young Ivy League grads, all having no childhood because they were tutored, nurtured, they were blessed, they were immaculately conceived, they were given a holy suburban or upper mobile professional tattywatt water each day to make sure that they were just so perfect that the sun never stopped shining on them like the British Empire. And they run off to Harvard. Now they find out there are 4,000 other people equally qualified. Then they run off to Wall Street, and there's 176,000 of them equally qualified. So they have no joy. There's no joy down there. Every bathroom has cocaine running through it, and that's their natural energy of the day, they think. So think of all the people on Wall Street, the fossil fuel industry, the private military-industrial complex, Monsanto, Google. Who can afford after work to go buy a $60 bottle of beer at one of the upscale, you know, millennial restaurants? These people. Do they have a life? Yeah, but the life they have is the one they despise. They want to get to a place where they can enjoy all the comfort of being successful, all the acknowledgement that they feel they deserve. And so they are clearly living in a vile cesspool of icy rain because there's no heart. You've never heard of a heart attack on any of the people on Wall Street because you got to have a heart attack. And there's no consciousness. Just make money. That's gluttony. And the fourth circle is greed. This hell's reserved for figures like Pluto, the Roman equivalent of the Greek god of the underworld, which was Hades. And there are two groups of greed, those who hoard possessions and those who lavishly spend it. Well, look at all the people that must show you how much they're making by their cars, their, you know, $3,000, you know, diamond-studded sneakers, and their wristwatches, that everything is overpaid. And or those people that hoard everything, like Hetty Green, the Witch of Wall Street, that was so rich, she was the richest woman in America, and she would go to the bank each day and count her money over and over again in a vault, and her own son lived in a slum and ended up dying because of being uncared for. So what you have is two sides of misery, and that's what comes from greed. And these are all the wannabe technocrats. These are the Silicon Valley twerp heads. And this is where, you know, these are the professional class, the attorneys for Goldman Sachs and Exxon. These are the elite who are climbing a greed ladder that never ends. And the fifth circle was anger, wrath and sullen, gloomy and bad tempers, always mean, always angry. And the other, it was on the surface of the river Styx, while the sullen gurgle beneath the surface of the water. And that is, look at Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, look at McChrystal, Petraeus, Colin Powell, Donald Trump, General Mattis. That's who would be in anger. They're always angry. Sixth circle was heresy. The Christians are apostates. Heretics. So think of all of us at WBAI and all of us at Progressive Radio Network and all the other activists in America. We are considered heresy. We're given no credibility. We're given no proper acknowledgement and forum. We are only talked about when you start off with a negative and never with a positive. It's as if we've never contributed anything to the larger social order, to human rights, to civil rights, to women's rights, to the earth rights, to animal rights. So we're the ones who's supposed to, like Dante, sixth circle, we're supposed to be condemned for eternity in tombs inflamed in constant conflict. Well, then you look at who's supposed to do this. Well, then you have your evangelical preachers, the prosperity gospel, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robinson, the rabbis promoting genocide of the Palestinians, the mullahs of militant jihad, the Wahhabi religious counselors of Saudi Arabia royal family. You have your seventh circle, which is violence. And this circle has three rings. The outer ring is a river of boiling blood and fire for murders and those who were violent towards others. Think of Alexander the Great, Guy de Montfort, Dionysus the First of Syracuse. And the middle ring is for suicides. Now, it doesn't mean a literal suicide, because there the remains turn into trees and bushes that are fed upon for eternity by harpies. And you've heard the word harping. Well, a harpy is someone that lives off denourishing another soul. And so think of the gossips. Think of the people that are maligners. Think of the people that never do anything constructive. And so all they do is commit a spiritual suicide by living through a completely non-energized life. In effect, they're always living through someone else. They love to be rescued. These are the whiners, the complainers. These are the people that are always calling themselves victims and putting on merit badges of distress every day. And we have gazillions of those. And the inner ring is a desert of burning sand and burning rain falling from the sky for blasphemers. And anyone who blasphemies is considered non-human. The eighth circle is fraud, seducers, pimps, hypocrites. And hypocrites were forced to walk eternally in lead-lined cloaks. And swindlers and cheats, well, there's your bankers, there's your investment people, and the cheats, and they're supposed to be dunked in boiling pitch. And then the simonists, the clergy who sell indulgences for personal profit. Well, think if you gave money to a presidential campaign, if you are a big bundler and giving up money, you're given an ambassadorship. Well, an ambassador should be someone with decades of experience in diplomacy. These people have no diplomacy. They have no manners. You see the kind of, you know, a sloven creature that just ended up running the communications down at the White House and how he was speaking. And that's who we have today. So they reside in Dante's eighth circle. And the ninth circle is treachery. And there are four rounds for four of those who Dante regards as the worst of humanity. Each is frozen in an icy lake. Cain for killing his brother Abel, the Antenor, who was the king of Troy, Priam's counselor during the Trojan War, and the traitor who turned Troy over to the Greeks, and then the governor of the Jericho region in Israel, who had his father-in-law and two brother-in-laws murdered at a banquet, and Judas Iscariot at the lowest round. Today we have Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., we have Barack Obama and Donald Trump, and that would behind them would be Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin, etc. And that would be my metaphor for taking something that Dante did that everyone should be highly literate in, and showing how we haven't evolved from there today. Thank you. I don't have time for more. We got to go to our guest, and I'm going to extend our program a little longer than normal today. And so I'm going to warn our regular stations, we will be taking a little extra time today because I want to go over and say hello to Mr. Pepper, Wham Pepper. And then from there, we will continue on an upcoming program. Now, many of the guests know that Wham Pepper is an international civil and human rights attorney based in New York, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray. And in 1967, Dr. King had reached out to Dr. Pepper regarding an essay he'd written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions. So he was president of Dr. King's famous Riverside Church. And he is also going to talk to us today about Sirhan. Sirhan, nice to have you with us today, Bill.
It's good to be with you, Gary.
Bill, the federal official report on the assassination of Robert Kennedy indicated that Sirhan was the lone gunman. And the report gives no indication whatsoever that there might have been others involved or a conspiracy in any way. And nevertheless, subsequent research and information and evidence, such as an audio recording at the time of the shooting, contradicts the government's claims. For example, more shots were heard and from different directions that would have been scientifically impossible for Sirhan to do given the revolver he used. So based upon the evidence at hand, at the time of the assassination, what do we know now for certain took place in the hotel when Robert was assassinated that shows this was a conspiratorial act and not the killing solely by a mentally deranged individual? The form is yours.
Thank you, Gary. Yes, I think it's one of the tragedies of and scandals of the American criminal justice system that you have cases like this that do not ever allow the kind of evidence you're talking about to be heard in an evidentiary hearing, much less a trial. Sirhan's lawyer at the time, Grant Cooper, was himself under a pending indictment and totally under the control of the prosecution. As a result, there was the most horrific errors made and statements made. He started off by talking to the jury in his opening comment, saying, "We're not here to free a guilty man. We know that our client is guilty." I mean, he condemned him right at the outset. The evidence that was not heard had to do with a whole variety of witnesses who saw Sirhan never any closer than 5 to 6 feet in front of the senator and getting off two sort of almost idyllically two shots. He had been in a mind control clinic for 2 weeks prior to going to the Ambassador Hotel and had been cued by a pinch by his handler to stand up at a point in time and pull a pistol and fire two shots in the front from the front at Bob Kennedy. Bob was hit with three bullets at powder burn range from the rear. So who the second shooter, the killer, was the one who knelt down behind him and put those three bullets in him. The final and fatal shot was put in behind his right ear. A bullet lodged in the neck was never matched to Sirhan's gun. Sirhan, after firing two shots, had his arm pinned to the table, and he had no longer any control over the gun. The Brzezinski recording that you mentioned indicated that 13 shots were fired with a high degree of technological support. And the direction of the shots was, there were two directions, east to west and west to east, so that the shooter was behind Bobby, was shooting in a different direction than Sirhan was. So I think the evidence was overwhelming, but it was never presented. The autopsy report by Dr. Tom Noguchi clearly cleared Sirhan on the basis of the ballistics evidence and the bullet entry wounds that I've just described. Noguchi stood by his opinion and would never vary from it. They fired him at one point. He came back in after a court hearing and was returned, but he's a very courageous man who indicated that. Now, Sirhan, this is 50 years ago. Sirhan has been in prison. That case has gone all the way through the state courts in California, through the California Supreme Court, and then through the federal system. Federal District Court, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and finally the Supreme Court. We have exhausted all domestic remedies without ever having a day in court to show this evidence that this man was guilty. I engaged Dr. Daniel Brown, who is maybe the world's leading expert on mind control. And Dan spent over 70 hours with Sirhan, and that is how we came up with the information about how he was mind controlled. Dan interviewed him both under hypnosis and free recall, and we were able to get a great deal of information. Well, what we've had to do, Gary, I only came on to represent him in 2007 when his first lawyer died, and the family came to me and asked me to look into this case, and it has a personal bent for me, as did the King case. I'm not a conspiracy buff across the board, but I was Bob Kennedy's Citizens Chairman in Westchester County when he ran for the Senate in 1964, and I was a kid with a large following of people, and so Bob asked me to handle his case. So I knew him personally and had a personal interest in getting the truth out on this case. Well, we failed in the American criminal justice system. So what we've done, and just did it last week, we have filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. We've gone outside of the American system. We filed a 215-page petition with that, the IACHR, on the basis that this man was never given a fair trial. Article 18 of the Declaration of Rights and Duties of Man under the OAS Treaty, to which America is subject, by the way, requires that a fair trial be given in this kind of circumstance. So that's the sort of the long and the short of it. We filed with the commission last week. We announced at a press conference at the National Press Club that we had done so. But as you know better than anyone, and continually remind your listeners, there is no mainstream or corporate media that will touch these cases or that will in any way deal with the evidence. If it was not by people like you, these cases would go unheard forever, be swallowed up in history. So that's where we are.
Okay, what I'd like to do is this. I have a lot of information on Sirhan Sirhan because back when Robert Blair Kaiser wrote his seminal book on RFK Must Die, RFK Must Die, and I had him on my radio show. I was the only one to do that at the time. And I actually have a photograph. I think it's from 1968, almost 50 years ago. So I would like to hear more of what the psychiatrist found. I'd like to also, I was on the radio with Candy Jones. She and her husband overnight, Long John Neville. But I had personal conversations because I was on there every day on WMCA. And we talked about this. And she was very open and candid about it. And I know that I know what she told me. And she had no reason to lie to me about her association with the CIA and her being brainwashed. So I'd like for you to spend 1 hour with us, if you can, either this Tuesday or the following Tuesday on the Progressive Commentary Hour, so you can lay out your entire case that you're going to give to the court so that those who are interested in what really was behind, who was behind, and what really happened with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy can be told. Are you up for it? One of those two?
Yes, I can do that. This Tuesday would be a problem, but I certainly could do it the following Tuesday if we can coordinate.
Then I will have Richard call you today, and we'll book you for 2 weeks Tuesday for a whole hour, because I want you to lay out your entire case, including that of the CIA's MK Ultra psychological and brainwashing research, and how Sirhan Sirhan was conditioned to believe that what he was doing was right, and how that's never been allowed to come up, and all the other inconsistencies and contradictions. So we'll look forward to seeing you 2 weeks Tuesday, all right?
I'll be happy to do that, Gary.
Thank you. Bill Pepper, and he is the author of The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and we will have him back. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.